Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of Friday, June 29th, 2012. We all know it could happen to us. One moment we have a place to live, the next we don't. And homeowners in the path of the Colorado wildfires are now experiencing that firsthand.
2 days after we were evacuated, we had an automatic deduction that came out of our account for our satellite dish network for TV that no longer existed. We still have to pay our mortgage, even for a house that's gone.
We'll talk with a couple who lost everything to the Hyde Park fire. They say as much as you think you're prepared, you're not. And later we head back to school for some Econ 101 in fourth grade.
Human capital is like your personal, it's how you are, I think.
Mm-hmm.
All the details that make you yourself alone.
Those stories plus the big healthcare ruling and your thoughts on financial independence coming up on Marketplace Money from APM.
Show Marketplace Money how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/marketplacemoney.
Happy 4th of July, everybody! Yeah, I know, we still have a few days to prep for all those barbecues and parades and fireworks. But meantime, let's hear some thoughts from you about financial independence.
My name is Roger Walker. I'm from Brunswick, Maine. And my definition of financial independence is something that my father taught me when I was fairly young. Essentially, he would say, you're rich when you're not worried about your well-being or your children's financial well-being, but you're more interested in the third generation, your grandchildren's financial well-being.
Yeah, my name is David Knutson. I live in Cincinnati, Ohio, and my idea of financial independence is knowing that I can buy ice cream for my daughters when I'd like to give them a treat. They're just not having to worry about having something a little special now and then.
My name is Jordan. I'm from Phoenix, Arizona, originally from Israel. Financial independence for me means that you can wake up in the morning and really think about what you want to do with your day.
I'm Daniel Snow from Salt Lake City, Utah. Well, financial independence is being able to pay your rent or your mortgage, eating enough healthy food, and building your savings without using credit cards.
And we'll hear more of your thoughts throughout the show. The wildfires in Colorado served as a reminder this week that financial independence, well, it needs to encompass the ability to survive catastrophe. Thousands of people lost everything in the inferno that's been burning for almost a month now. Among them, Mike and Sharon Gooley of Paradise Park. They were evacuated 3 weeks ago. They're still living in a hotel. The Hyde Park fire took their home and their livelihood. They don't have access to the building where they made historic Old West clothing. Mike and Sharon, join us now. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Tell us where you are right now.
At the moment, we are sitting in the Cash Bank and Trust building in downtown Fort Collins.
And how far are you from your home?
25, 30 miles.
All right. Well, tell us why you're there.
On June 9th, we received a call from a neighbor that there was a fire within our area. And about an hour and a half after that, we received an urgent evacuation notice.
So your neighbor called you first.
Our neighbor had heard there was something going on. We looked out. We saw the smoke. When the phone call came in, it was extremely urgent. Get out now.
So at that point, we just started grabbing everything. I would say we probably had about 2 hours.
An hour and a half.
And they would have liked us to have been gone sooner.
Jeez.
And we had two buildings to evacuate because we have a home. And then about 30 feet away, we have a second building where we run our business.
How do you go about deciding within those 2 hours what you're going to take and what you're going to leave?
Believe it or not, in my case, it was take all the goods that I've already produced, take anything of value that if I have to, I can sell it, because we are our income. We produce and we make, and that's our income. So anything that had value that I could sell.
You know, I think anyone who lives in the West lives with this possibility. Had you two talked at all about how you would go about evacuating your home if this happened?
I actually, the way I built the property is I built three large ponds right in front of the house. So if there was a fire, they could even bring in some sort of a fire truck, hook into the ponds, and protect the property. But this was not a normal fire. Hmm. This was it's just not reacting like fire does.
What is the situation with your house now?
It's gone. Basically, our house burnt to the ground.
Well, we received word the day after we were evacuated that a firestorm had indeed swept through our neighborhood. And at that point, it was pretty dire. We did start hearing rumors trickling out, and by the next day, one of the local news channels had flown over our neighborhood and took pictures. And we were able to see visual evidence that our house was gone, and that was terrible. But the good news was our studio with all of our business supplies was still standing.
Yeah, it's quite – you got to understand, this is not a neighborhood like most people will think. We're between houses. There's a quarter mile to a half mile separation.
It's been then, what, 3 weeks since you were evacuated. What kind of financial burden has that put on you?
I happen to have a good insurance company. These guys have been fabulous. We went to our agent, and our agent gave us a check on the spot to cover our everyday expenses for right now.
How much was that?
He gave us $5,000. Yeah. But the way this works is everything that you have to spend normally, you still have to, comes out of your pocket. And since we don't have income coming in because the business is essentially shut down, we're just going to be working off what we had saved. And for hotels and motels and clothing and that kind of stuff, that's what we're using the insurance money for.
For example, I think the day, 2 days after we were evacuated, we had an automatic deduction that came out of our account for our satellite dish network for TV that no longer existed. But, you know, they don't know that. They're just still taking funds out. We still have to pay our mortgage, even for a house that's gone. And once we get into temporary housing, we still have to pay first month, last month rent, damage deposit, and then sort things out with the insurance company afterward.
I just got the REA bill, which is our Rural Electric Association, for electricity, and all the power poles are burnt down and they have to go and rebuild everything. So we're still going to have to pay those bills, but you know what? We're up and we're walking and we're alive and we're happy.
You are then right now without a home, without a way to make a living. How confident are you that you'll be able to basically find a way to pay those bills, to pay your daily living expenses while you get back up and running somehow?
You know, I have been working for myself since 1975. Sharon has been working for herself for the last 15, 20 years. We are the business. It's not a building. It's not what's up there. It's us. And we're just very positive, confident people.
I hear that.
Yeah. One way or the other, it's going to work out. And we will be able to cover everything because that's who we are.
Do you feel like you were financially prepared for something like this?
A little bit, yes. I always try to have what I call a stash, you know?
Yeah.
You keep something aside just in case. You never know what's going to happen. And so you keep that sitting there just in case.
Well, let me ask you guys, you know, you have just experienced this. This is still very raw for you. What's the one piece of advice that you would give to our listeners who perhaps have not really thought about this as much as they should, whether it's earthquake, hurricane, tornado, fire, what have you?
You're always told that you should plan for an emergency. If you had to go, what would you take with you? What, you know, papers, insurance, what, where will you meet your family and friends? What items should you have in place for just such a situation? How can you prepare your home for such a situation to, in our case, to make it easier for the professionals to defend it? You know, we did a lot of that, but some things you say, I'll get to that next week. Don't wait, because you would have so much more peace of mind when you evacuate, knowing you had done all that you could.
Well, I think the most important advice that I can give is to learn how to be self-sufficient and self-reliant. Because if you're going to sit back and say, well, somebody's going to cover my butt, well, they might not. And so you can't really rely on the government or Red Cross or anything. You first have to start with yourself. Once you feel confident in yourself, then from there, when you need services, you can approach it from a powerful point of position versus from a point of weakness.
The authorities were there immediately with an evacuation shelter set up. The Red Cross was there immediately. But just a few days after the shelter was set up, they had to move it because the smoke was so bad in that area. And if you're relying on someone else to completely take care of you, you always should have your own backup plan, because people will help you as much as they can, but you also have to plan for it yourself. And that really is what people need to prepare for.
Well, Mike and Sharon, we wish you all the best as you recover from this natural disaster. Thank you so much for speaking with us. Can we check back with you in 6 months, see how you're doing?
Sure. No problem.
Great. Well, thank you again.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
Well, when you hear a story like Mike and Sharon's, you can't help but ask yourself, if fire is heading my way, I have 20 minutes, what do I take with me? Photographer Foster Huntington asked that question on his blog, and responses poured in from around the world. They're now in his soon-to-be-released book, The Burning House, and he's here with us in studio. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Why did you decide to do this book? Is this something that you experienced yourself?
Never really happened to me, but I've always been interested in how people's possessions and what they value kind of reflect their backgrounds and their personal priorities.
You have pages in this book from all over the world. How did you gather those images?
So I pretty much, when I started the website, I kind of asked some of my friends to take photos and established like kind of a quality template and like what the format's going to be. And then I opened it up for submissions and they just started flowing in. And I didn't really go out and facilitate them. They just kind of responded to it. And the great thing about the question is that as soon as you ask it, people like immediately start thinking what they would take. And with like kind of the proliferation of really good digital cameras, so many people can take good photos these days.
Well, I have your book with us here in the studio, and although we're on radio, I'll try to describe some of these pictures. One that really struck out to me was taken by Michelle Ashton. She's 27 years old in London. She sent this photo, and I'll remind you what it is here. It's of a MacBook, but also a stuffed teddy bear.
Yeah. Now that everyone's lives are so online, it's like a computer represents that life. It's like the portal to all these other things. So a bunch of people say they'd bring their laptop, but they're not really bringing the laptop. They're bringing the life that they can kind of access through that and their connections. And then that is really juxtaposed by this teddy bear that has so much sentimental value, but it's worthless in terms of value. I'm interested in that kind of dichotomy where it's like something that on the face of it seems really valuable, but the stuff that's valuable about that laptop isn't really the material cost of it. It's the world it represents.
And the bear had already been in one fire before.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that's been so interesting for me is just seeing these, like, life is always stranger than you can imagine. And a lot of these objects in there really represent that.
It seems that a lot of these contributors seem to wrestle, and I think all of us would wrestle with how to balance whether you take something that's very useful, very utilitarian, or, you know, beloved items, photographs.
Yeah, I mean, and photographs are, a lot of them are irreplaceable, especially before the digital age,
right,
with all the negatives and those memories. Like, once you lose those, they're gone forever.
And what about that notion of, you know, utilitarian versus emotional?
I mean, that's like kind of a conflict that we're always faced with. You know, it's like, should I do the sentimental thing or the practical thing? And this question really kind of forces you to evaluate that.
Foster Huntington's book is The Burning House, What Would You Take? I think it's just a really fascinating question. So thank you for asking it. And thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And because it's such a fascinating question, we would like to hear from you. And in fact, we asked our fans on Twitter and Facebook earlier this week. You can see their responses in a Storify. Go to marketplace.org and submit your own response there as well. The healthcare reform decision from the Supreme Court is up next on Marketplace Money from APM.
My name is Shane Jordan from Birmingham, Alabama. And when I think of financial independence, I think of having savings enough to retire, having a house that's paid for, as well as college savings for my children.
I'm Kevin Newman from New Paltz, New York. financial independence would be being the 1%, or at least not being in the precariat. That is such a precarious situation that it feels like the rug is going to be pulled out from underneath me every 5 minutes.
My name is Gail. I'm from Houston, and my idea of financial independence is own, don't owe. When I was 6, my mother always said, don't spend more than you make. 50 years later, everything else still applies. I was self-employed. I paid off my mortgage about 10 years ago, and I did that by paying each month toward the principal. I use credit cards for everything that I buy. I pay my balance off at the end of the month. I have no debt, manage my own retirement accounts, and plan on living happily ever after.
Sounds like a plan. Well, you could argue Chief Justice John Roberts exercised a little independence this week, if not financial. Roberts, of course, was the swing vote in the Supreme Court's ruling on the Affordable Care Act. Now that the law has been upheld, or most of it at least, we thought we'd ask Marketplace's Adrian Hill to parse some of it for us and remind us what happens next with this law. Hi, Adrian.
Hi, Tess.
So a lot of folks have gotten into a lather about this individual mandate, but I don't think it really is a mandate, right? Does everybody have to buy insurance?
They don't, not really. And it's a whole lot of drama, but not about a real mandate here. There are a lot of people without insurance who still aren't going to have to buy it.
Okay, like who?
Well, there are a ton of exclusions in the law. People who are members of some religious groups are excluded, Native Americans, people in jail, and people who just can't afford health insurance.
Well, what does that mean, you can't afford it? Can any of us say that?
I know, it sounds like it, right? You've got to show that health insurance available in your market costs more than 8% of your income, or that you make so little that you don't have to file federal income tax. Hmm. But you remember, a lot of folks are going to qualify for federal subsidies to help pay for their insurance. And Medicaid, which is for poor and disabled people, could be expanded, at least on a state-by-state basis.
So is there any estimate of how many people will not have to buy insurance?
Yeah, about 40% of the people who currently don't have insurance before the Affordable Care Act mm-hmm. won't have to buy insurance with all these exclusions in place.
Wow. Okay. So that is actually a lot of people.
It is. So individual mandate is maybe overstating it just a bit.
All right. Well, that seems to be a lot of people. So say you are one of those people who does need to buy insurance, but you don't want to. There is this tax penalty, or this, it was called a penalty.
Now it's
a tax. And now we know it's a tax.
Yes. The IRS will collect it. But in 2014, we're not talking a lot of money. For an individual, it's about $100 if you haven't done this, or 1% of your income. That jumps up in 2016 to $700, or 2.5% of your income. So we're talking more money in 2016 than in 2014.
And what if I'm grumpy at the IRS and the law, and I just decide that I don't want to pay for insurance or pay my tax for not paying the insurance? Are they going to come after me?
You don't have to worry about too much, Tess. Actually, in the law, the IRS can't take criminal action or put a lien on your house.
Wait, so I'd be off the hook? Like, neener, neener, IRS?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, what the IRS can do is they can deduct the tax penalty from your refund if you're owed a refund. Otherwise, you're going to get a strongly worded letter. Mm. Dear Tess, pay up. Love, the IRS.
Oh, that's scary.
Yeah, but it is a strongly worded letter from the IRS, so it is kind of scary.
Okay, well, so basically we have a mandate with no real severe punishment here. Let's move on and talk about how else this is going to affect my pocketbook.
Well, it completely depends on who you are and what your circumstance is, and the law is going to affect different people in a ton of different ways. Just a few, if you have a pre-existing condition, so if you weren't able to get health insurance before, or if you're paying more for health insurance, by 2014, insurers can't charge more for health insurance for those people. Mm-hmm. And so it's going to save people in that pool a ton of money, and maybe make access to health care available, which wasn't before.
Okay.
High earners, people who make over $200,000, are going to have to pay more Medicare tax.
And I've actually heard that some folks are going to be getting rebates from their insurance companies as part of all this.
That's right. In the summer, insurers are sending out $1.1 billion to individuals and employers who overpaid in insurance. As part of the law, insurance companies have to spend 80% of the premiums they take from us mm-hmm. on actual health care.
Not overhead.
Not bonuses.
Right.
And
right.
Overhead. So $1.1 billion going back to people. We're talking about people who do get checks are getting about $150 in the mail, but that's not going to be a lot of people.
All right. And what about those of us who already do have health insurance?
Well, a lot of the parts of the plan benefit people with employer health insurance too. So coverage for kids going up to 26, coverage coverage of preventative services, all those reforms still help people.
And a lot of those have kicked in already.
A lot of those have kicked in. This bill doesn't mean that rates are going to magically fall. I mean, premiums and deductibles have been going up, and they may very well continue to go up.
All right. Thanks, Adrian.
Thanks, Tess.
So about a week ago, I became one of those people. I stand all day, at least when I'm at work. Now, why? Well, I read one too many articles about how if you sit all day, you will die. Okay, I'm over-dramatizing just a little bit, but I'm one of several who stand around the Marketplace newsroom at our desks, of course. And we are not alone. Here's reporter Karen Burkett.
So I'm just going to tell you a story from my office today. The Miami Herald. Yes, the Miami Herald houses radio studios. We produce NPR stories here. Anyway, I work in a room full of journalists who for much of the day give their complete attention to their keyboards and computer screens. Not too much gets this crowd to stand up, or to even walk around. Except for the Cuban coffee. Mauro makes it any afternoons. So anyway, there's this woman in the newsroom. Her name is Deb Acosta. She fights some nasty Miami traffic to make it to work every day. Do you have any back problems?
No back problems.
Do you have any breathing problems?
No.
She's in her 20s, thin, energetic, smiley. Looks pretty healthy to me. Do you smoke?
No.
Do you work out?
No.
Since the beginning of the year, every time I look up, she's been right there in my direct line of vision. Standing. See, Deb created a standing desk.
What are you doing? I'm working.
Why are you standing?
It makes me feel better.
When did you start doing this?
I started doing this at the beginning of the year, right after vacation.
You stand all day?
I stand all day except when I'm driving into work and when I'm having lunch.
Now, Deb didn't buy an actual standing desk. Yes, they sell them online and at stores like IKEA. She reconfigured her desk to make it ergonomically correct. It's makeshift. She used a couple of cardboard boxes, some thick hardcover books, and filing shelves. I wasn't the only one who noticed her new posture.
A lot of other people have been like, I've noticed you've been standing. Do you stand every day? What's going on? Some other people are like, are you leaving? Where are you going?
Deb got to me. Somewhere between hearing a talk show doctor say, if I could tell people to do just one thing to improve their health, it would be stand. And my own personal push to be consistent about going to the gym again. Because let's face it,
Mom, did you go hold it?
My 2-year-old Celia thinks tag is just the best game ever. I started to stand. I did the research. I called Dr. Alpa Patel. She's an epidemiologist.
Our study suggested that if you sit more than 6 hours a day compared to sitting less than 3 hours a day, you will die prematurely.
Die prematurely? The study Dr. Patel is talking about is the one she wrote for the American Cancer Society. It says women who sat for more than 6 hours a day were 37% more likely to die prematurely than women who sat for 3 hours. For men, the rate was 18%.
Well, when we think about technology, it used to be that you had to actually get up and go to a coworker's desk, but now you can instant message them, you can pick up the phone, you can send them an email. You don't have to actually be active. You actually can go and sit in your office for the entire day, and other than for a bathroom break, you don't really have to get up.
Is there a conclusion that standing is better for you?
What we do know is that even taking short breaks from that sitting time, as little as 2 to 5 minutes an hour, can have tremendous health benefits. So the bottom line is get up and stand.
As it turns out, employees in Silicon Valley at companies like Facebook or Citrix, they've been doing this a while. They pushed for standing desks. There are 3,000 employees at Facebook and about 350 standing desks at the offices. Employers have started to push wellness programs. In the long run, those companies know they're reducing health insurance costs. In the Miami Herald newsroom, Deb, Ari, Hannah, Jared, me, it's 5 of us who are now standing. We're all doing it for our different reasons, but it's supposed to improve energy, help with weight loss, good posture, even your breathing. One of my coworkers, Marco, he raised a concern.
For example, my dad was so worried about varicose veins because being a surgeon, he will stand for hours operating.
True, but maybe that's the reason you should take sitting breaks.
I definitely feel more energized. The fact that I'm standing there, if I get distracted by some silly YouTube video, I kind of notice it more easily. Like, oh, wait a second. I'm standing here. I need to get work done.
Oh, more focused employees for the employer. Are you listening, CEOs? But for me, it's a small change to make at the workplace for my good health. From One Herald Plaza in Miami, I'm Karen Burkett for Marketplace.
Standing desks seem to be sweeping the nation these days. Have they invaded your workplace yet? Well, if they have, send us a photo. We will showcase it on a special page at marketplace.org.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
This is Marketplace Money from APM. We were all taught to share as kids. After all, you know, it's the nice thing to do. So when we grow up and we can buy our own things, some of us tend to relish the idea that we don't have to share anymore. Our food, our clothes, our grown-up toys like electronics and cars. But there's a movement afoot called the sharing economy. It says owning things just bogs us down, and sharing offers more freedom, financially and otherwise. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Eve Tro reports.
The more expensive something is, the more sense it makes to share it. A vacation home for the weekend, a designer dress for that black tie dinner, even that most prized American possession, the car. There are now apps and websites for all those things. Sharing's now a way to flex your tech. Let's focus on cars. We'll start with me and my smartphone. So I am here at beautiful Santa Fe Station, train station here in San Diego, and I'm going to open my Car2Go app. Car2Go is a car sharing company owned by the German automaker Daimler. San Diego, California is one of a few U.S. cities where it operates. The app pings my location, and available cars pop up on a map.
I think this is the one I want.
The fleet, all little white electric smart cars, is scattered around town. Users leave the cars anywhere in the service area.
2,000 feet away from where I am, so I will walk toward it now.
And there I meet.
My name is Omar Passons. I'm an attorney. My building is actually right behind us.
Omar has his own car, drives it from home to his office every day. But he leaves his car at work and uses Car2Go to scoot around downtown for meetings or lunch in Little Italy.
Quite frankly, I'm kind of a foodie. I don't have time normally at lunch to trudge 10 blocks up and hang out for an hour and trudge back.
Omar swipes an access card across a digital panel. The car unlocks and we climb in.
All right.
He pays 35 cents a minute, cheaper than a cab, and the city gives car sharing vehicles free parking at meters. No keys to exchange. The car starts with a push button. And the interior, despite multiple users, is spotless.
People who use Car2Go are surprisingly clean, which is cool.
Omar chalks that up to the social nature of Car2Go. People tweet constantly about using it. They friend other Car2Goers on Facebook.
There's something about that dynamic of our society right now that makes Car2Go work better than it would otherwise.
That part is newfangled and techy. But the pay-as-you-go model? That's old school. Very. In 1916, an Omaha businessman placed this ad and became the first to offer automobiles for hire.
Five-passenger Ford for rent. Perfect running condition, nearly new. We'll rent to reliable party by hour, day, week, or month. My charges are per mile. The only reasonable arrangement.
That per-mile, only reasonable arrangement is an old way of doing things. Car2Go CEO Nicholas Cole says consumers are drawn back to it because digital culture is all about efficiency.
Where you used to go out to a record store and buy the CD, now, you know, you get online and you buy the songs that you want. So you want to pay for what you're going to use.
Apply that idea to owning a car, and all the hours or days you don't use your car are like the songs you never listen to on an album. When Krista Kaiser moved to San Francisco, she found she barely used her car and racked up hundreds of dollars in parking tickets.
I was like, this is a city telling me that I shouldn't have a car.
So she gave it up. Now, when she needs a car for a few hours or a few days, she's found Relay Rides. It lets her rent other people's cars.
So, enter in your dates, and it's going to tell you how far away these different cars are.
One she likes, a black 2005 Prius. The car is owned by Katarina Rindy. She lives a few miles away. So that's your car?
Yeah, that's my car, the Proton.
Why is it called that?
Because I'm a nerd, pretty much.
Katarina's Relay Rides profile shows her with her car, called the Proton, and user reviews. She makes a few $100 a month, on average, renting out her Prius. When renter Krista requests that Prius, owner Katarina sees her profile, too. That builds trust. But even good people get in accidents. Katarina says it takes a mental shift to share your car.
I think I've let go of that this is my baby kind of thing. I treat it more as a tool, I think, than I used to.
Her car's been scraped, left with a dead battery, but she says Relay Rides takes care of that stuff, and her belief in the idea of sharing outweighs any inconvenience. Krista, the renter, says car sharing's piqued her interest in sharing all kinds of things.
I have, you know, a tennis racket, I have skis and ski boots. I'd be happy to lend these things to my neighbors.
It's not just technology, but the recession that spurred this sharing economy.
People are getting very rigorous about really squeezing all the value out of what they have.
That's Lisa Gansky, author of The Mesh, and a venture capitalist who's backed Relay Rides, among other companies.
We're moving to a world in which access to goods, services, and talent will triumph over the ownership of them.
But there is pushback from insurance companies, for one. Some are starting to say if you rent out a car or house or other item that they cover, they're not going to share the burden with you if the worst happens. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
Coming up, reading, writing, and opportunity cost?
If you do opportunity A and you want to go to both of them, you have to think of doing them in separate times, right?
Elementary students learning elementary economics later on Marketplace Money from 8 p.m. The town of Roxana, Illinois, sits at the endpoint of one of the country's biggest oil pipelines. Oil's been good to Roxana. Once upon a time, three refineries, along with steel mills and manufacturing plants, employed tens of thousands of people. But then the economy changed. The factories and two of the refineries shut down. And in 1986, one of the pipelines that brings oil to Roxana broke. And the town has been living with the consequences ever since. Producer Scott Carrier reports.
Roxana, Illinois is a small town of 1,600 people, located 1 mile from the eastern bank of the Mississippi River, about 15 miles upstream from St. Louis. It has a library, two stoplights, a couple of hair salons. The houses are small, nothing fancy. It's a nice place to live, except the air smells like a mix between a feedlot and new asphalt, because there's a refinery next to the village that processes up to 300,000 barrels of crude oil every day.
That's the smell of money.
Donnie and Chrissy O'Dell own the King Louis Drive-In.
That's what's kept everybody working. And again, both of us being 45 years old, almost 45, and being raised around here, that's what we were always told. That's the smell of money.
Do you worry about your kids?
Yeah, I mean, once in a while, I think, you know, it can't be good to breathe that every day.
How come you don't move? How come people here don't move out of town?
People around here are just, to be honest with you, they're good, hardworking people, and they do care about the community, and that's, again, why we stay in business, because these people have been around here forever. They appreciate the small businesses, and they stay.
This is a baseball game. The Roxana High School Shells versus the Greenville Comets. They use the name Shells because for years the refinery was owned and operated by Shell Oil. The school sits next to the refinery. white clouds billowing from 5 or 6 smokestacks. Roxana has always been an industrial blue-collar town. The first refinery was built here in 1918, and the town grew up around it. In its heyday, there were 3 refineries employing thousands of people. ConocoPhillips now owns the 1 remaining refinery, employing 900, but only 6 people who live in Roxana work at the refinery. Anybody with a refinery job makes enough money to move out of town and get away from the smell and the dangerous chemicals. The average price for a single-family home in the Roxana zip code is $62,000, while about 20 miles to the east, in the Edwardsville area, the average price is about 5 times that, at just over $300,000.
I would love to get out of here.
Jack Brown is a bus mechanic for the Roxana schools. In 1997, he was diagnosed with leukemia, a type of blood cancer he believes was caused by benzene that spilled from a refinery pipeline in 1986.
You know, I don't want to go far. I want away from the refinery. I got too much vested in my career here, and I love my career here. The more I could be away from this place, it'd be the better. I think that's for anybody.
In 1986, back when Shell was managing the Roxana refinery, a pipeline running from the refinery to the Mississippi River leaked about 9,000 gallons of benzene, a known carcinogen, into the ground just outside the village limits. Shell cleaned up the benzene that came to the surface, but much of the spill stayed underground. The plume migrated and is now directly beneath parts of Roxana. Shell has dug a series of test holes about 50 feet deep to monitor the benzene plume, and one hole shows levels 260,000 times the allowable limit. And now, people in this neighborhood have leukemia. Scott Monroe is one of them. He's 21 years old. 3 years ago, he graduated from Roxana High and was given a large scholarship from the U.S. Navy. He wanted to be a nuclear engineer.
I was always a good test taker. I did well on the ACTs. I had really good grades throughout elementary school, junior high, and high school.
So Scott left Roxana and went to the University of Michigan with high hopes and a lot of confidence. But very quickly, in his first semester, he started to feel really lousy.
I was struggling with focusing. I was just getting too exhausted and worn out. Just common things like even taking a shower. And I'm not a person that gives up very easily at all. I've never really given up on anything. I've always pushed hard, but I just couldn't find it within myself to stay there. And I requested that my scholarship be revoked, and I came back home. You know, I knew something was going on. I just didn't know what.
When Scott came home, he went to see a doctor. And after a series of tests, he was told he had acute myelogenous leukemia and should immediately check into the cancer ward at a hospital in St. Louis. Scott is now in remission, but there's no guarantee he won't relapse.
If you go out my back door, walk across the alley, I had a best friend who died about 3 years ago of lung cancer, Angie Webster.
Trixie and Bud Williford live just next door to Scott. Bud has blood cancer too, and Trixie has a long list of other people in the neighborhood.
If you walk down 3 or 4 or 5 houses, I don't know which, same block, Mrs. Myers died of a blood disease that they never did identify. That house next to her years ago, can't tell you how many years, Mrs. Medkit died of liver cancer. Come back in the house, go out my front door, walk across the street to my neighbor's yard and go in their alley, and a man died 3 years ago of leukemia. Then on this side, there's Bob Evans, has colon cancer. Steve Stamper has brain cancer. Fred Hubbard, one of our former mayors, died of cancer. I can't remember which kind. They all lived on the east side of town between Tiedemann and 8th Street.
The Illinois Department of Public Health has done 2 studies and 1 review of the rates of cancer in the Roxana area, covering the time period from 1985 to 2008. And yet, the results show no significant increase. Yes, according to epidemiologists, Roxana is not a cancer hotspot. Marty Reynolds is the Public Works Director for the town of Roxana.
I've lived here in Roxana 52 out of my 56 years. And I can look around and count multitudes of people that I know have died of cancer. But I can't dispute what the Illinois Department of Public Health tells me, that from their statistics, there's not a cancer hotspot in this area. It doesn't make sense. Everything that you hear, everything that you read in terms of chemical exposure, you would think this would glow red on a map for the incidence of environmental-related cancers. But if the Department of Public Health is not telling me that's so, then it's certainly not my forte in analyzing it.
Shell's response is, quote, "Our primary concern is for the safety and well-being of the Roxana community," unquote. Meanwhile, some of the cancer victims have filed lawsuits against Shell, and now the people here in the shadow of these refineries don't know what to think. Does their town smell of money, or disease, or both, or something else? In Roxana, Illinois, I'm Scott Carrier for Marketplace.
This story was originally produced for Burn, an energy journal from Sound Vision Productions, with support from the National Science Foundation. This is Marketplace Money from APM.
My name's Beth, and I'm from Chicago, Illinois. Financial independence means that I am able to make the decisions in my life rather than having money or not enough money make the decisions about what I get to do or have.
My name is Ruzbe, and I live in Santa Monica, California. To me, being financially independent means picking up the check when I go out to eat with my mom or dad. I say this because growing up, I was always hesitant or felt guilty when accepting money from my parents. This was particularly true when I was aware that the family was going through a period of financial strain. What I wasn't cognizant of, however, was that my parents were constantly investing in me. So, when I get the opportunity to treat mom or dad to a meal, it's also a chance to discuss my future goals and show them that I'm on sound financial footing. Hopefully, they'll see that their investment is beginning to pay off.
When it comes to financial independence, the earlier the better, right? Kids would certainly agree. Who wants to ask mom and dad for money? And many parents would be more than happy to surrender their position as financial overlords and the family bank. But how early do you start teaching real economic concepts? How does elementary school sound? Recess may be the favorite part of the day at St. Anne's, a Catholic elementary and middle school in Santa Monica. But the lesson they're about to get in Anna Renteria's fourth grade class will surely run a close second.
The only thing that I want on your desk is a pencil.
Oh.
Ms. Renteria quieted the class and handed it over to the day's guest instructors.
I'm Chris Tesserero. I go to Loyola High School. My favorite subject is economics, and today we're teaching about economics.
Tesserero and his classmate Conrad Ucropina, both 18 years old, we're at St. Anne's to talk the kids through some very basic tenets of finance.
Today, we'll be teaching about opportunity costs, which is something we'll go into in a little bit, but I just want to see if you guys remember anything from the last lesson we had on economics and human capital. Already got a hand up. So what do you think, Stephen?
Human capital is like your personal, like how, it's how you are, I think.
Mm-hmm.
All the details that make you yourself alone.
Mm-hmm. It's very good. Anyone want to add on to that? Yes, Aaron.
It's like who you are and how you feel.
That's a great response. Basically, human capital is the individual skills that you have.
The visit was part of a program created 3 years ago by Tesserero and Ucropina's high school economics teacher. Brian Held sends his Loyola students out to low-income schools to teach the fundamentals of finance to younger kids.
An old expression in the ed world is that teaching is learning. So by them going out to teach, I'm hopefully reinforcing to them just how important the economic concepts are for them to know, but also for the kids that they're teaching it to.
Sure, yeah. All right, well, basically,
Opportunity cost is basically with any choice that you make, like choosing, let's say it's a Friday night and you have to choose between, you know, going to a movie or, you know, staying home and studying, because I know that's what I do on Friday nights. The opportunity cost is everything that you lose by not taking choice B.
That's exactly it, yeah.
If you do opportunity A and you want to go to both of them, you have to think of doing them in separate times, right?
Okay, so it takes a little more explaining for 10-year-olds. But the key here is the rapt attention being lavished on the visiting teachers. These are high school people, high school star athletes, to be specific. So if you're going to learn about human capital and opportunity cost, you might as well learn it from the cool kids, right? And Tesserero and Yucrepina, well, they get that.
Some kids, you know, at young stages, they can go into high school and see, you know, instant money and working at like McDonald's or something like that and say, why college? That's just debt. I can earn money now. And, you know, what we're trying to convey to them in human capital and opportunity cost lessons are that stay in school. You can make more money in the future and be more successful and reach your full potential.
We're trying to tie everything back into school, trying to get them to realize that their best chance to create their own human capital is through school. Do you guys like these?
Pretty cool. We made them.
Yeah.
Wow, talk about creativity.
As the youngsters watched, their guest teachers put on, yes, kitchen aprons with pockets that contained tchotchkes from different theme parks.
So today, guys, we are going to be making a trip. Let's imagine that it's your birthday, and we are either going to Disneyland or Legoland. And, you know, there's opportunity cost to both options. But it really comes down to what decision you guys want to make.
They proceeded to outline a simple cost-benefit analysis to the theme parks, and the kids then made decisions about where they'd want to go. In the end, it was evident that the messages were getting through.
I'm Sarah, and I'm 10 years old. I've learned that you should, like, pick the right thing that you want to choose, and then you can do the other one another time.
Right. So it's all about choices, right? Who else?
My name's Arlene, and I'm 10, and I learned that money doesn't matter. You can use it for a time where you really need it.
Okay. How about over there?
My name is Daniela, and I'm 9 years old, and what I learned from Chris and Conrad is that I should really do the right thing and choose what is really important.
Good. One more?
My name is Stephen Townsend. I am 9.5 years old. I'm turning 10 this July 5th.
And happy birthday.
I've learned about a lot of things that you can miss on by making just one choice, and what choices can be really hard to make.
See, I told you we could all learn about finance from fourth graders. And finally to this week's Marketplace Money Piggy Award. Our little blue plastic friend is heading to New York City. Some background here, though. I love handwritten letters. Old school correspondence will always get my attention. So when I got one from Carol Bellinger with her Piggy nomination, well, first I took a picture of it, and then I tweeted it, and then we asked her to read it.
I would like to nominate Victoria Bellinger for your Piggy Award. During a year of unemployment between jobs, she paid all of her bills with the aid of unemployment and selling her few possessions, only sparingly dipping into savings. She never once came to us for a loan. To save money when socializing with friends, she brought Jell-O to their get-togethers. What started as a money-saving strategy ended up as a published cookbook. Now employed, she is again building up her savings, and her friends are still clamoring for her Jell-O treats. Sincerely, Carol Bellinger, proud mother.
Well, it doesn't sound like she needs him, but of course Victoria gets a pig. Well done, and congrats on the new job, too. Piggy loves the city, so feel free to squire him around New York. Maybe just stay away from the meatpacking district. Oink, oink. And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Like us on Facebook and follow me on Twitter at Tess Vigeland. Next time, the recession hits healthcare jobs.
So you're getting a lot of new nurses coming out of school into a market where some of them are having trouble finding jobs, which is a very unusual phenomenon historically.
Marketplace Money is produced by Patty Hirsch with Devin Maverick Robbins and Joel Patterson. Thanks also this week to Liza Madry. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark, and the Marketplace General Manager is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Vigeland. Happy 4th, everyone. This is APM,